Welcome to the Educause podcast. This podcast is sponsored by Real Networks and features a session from the Educause 2008 annual conference. Participants include Philippa Levy, Professor of Learning and Teaching at CILASS at the University of Sheffield, and Martin J. Lewis, Director of Library Services and University Librarian at the University of Sheffield. The session is entitled Bringing the Information Commons Home.
I'm Andrew Bonamici, Associate University Librarian for Instructional Services at the University of Oregon. I'm very pleased to introduce our speakers this morning. Phil Levy, who is Professor of Learning and Teaching at the University of Sheffield, and Martin Lewis, Director of Library Services and University Librarian at the University of Sheffield, who are here to talk to us about their information commons at Sheffield, bringing the information commons home. I think you'll really enjoy this presentation. This project is very exciting, you know, both in execution of its design and in its programmatic vision. Before I let the speakers carry on, though, I would like to encourage you to do your part for the Educause community and fill out the evaluation forms, either at the kiosks or on the Educause conference website after you've returned home. So, Martin and Phil.
Well, thank you very much for that, Andrew. And apologies, everybody, for the fire alarm. That was just a little exercise intended to show us who had hangovers this morning. And I'm pleased to say you all performed very well, actually much better than the speakers, but that's another story. A warm welcome, as Andrew has said, and really what we want to do today is to talk to you about a particular project and to some extent to offer it to you as a case study for discussion. And our intention is to give you a little bit of opportunity at the end of the session to ask questions and perhaps to tease out some of the general issues relating to the design and implementation of new learning spaces. We thought about a number of titles, really, for this presentation. And one that occurred to us was Built on a Hunch, because there was a great deal of guesswork involved in the information commons. And we'll come on, I think, a little later in the presentation to the way in which we approach the design and implementation of a building on this scale. The other one is the right building at the right time, because I think even doubters about the project have now come to the conclusion that actually we've ended up with a building that is very much of its time and captures the kind of zeitgeist in terms of new learning spaces. And given the lead time for major capital projects, it's interesting to reflect on what processes went into that early thinking and what lessons we can learn for the future design of learning spaces. So this, then, is the information commons, open for fresh thinking, a little teaser of the building here. But Phil and I, between us, are going to cover these areas broadly. So we're going to look at the drivers for building the thing, the process of designing it, and the partnerships involved. And then we're going to explore the relationship between pedagogy and architecture, using this building as a case study, before speculating a little bit about the reasons for choosing this particular name. So, first of all, in terms of the drivers for this development, this is a picture of the Western Bank Library at my university. I'm very proud of it. It's a building which I first glimpsed in a slide presentation when I was at library school, more years ago than I really care to mention. And the lecturer at library school had just shown us some pictures of excellent building design, the kind of modular designs for libraries that were becoming prevalent in the 1970s. And then he said, I'm going to show you now some examples of really appalling library design. And the very first picture that he popped up on the screen was of this building. And little did I know that years later I would be responsible for it. So, in terms of thinking about the drivers for our new information commons, one of the key things was that the university library at Sheffield was full. It was full of books, and it was absolutely chock full of people. There was no room for anybody to sit down, especially at examination and assessment time, and we clearly needed more space. Student satisfaction was low. We were aware that a lot of other universities in the UK had been investing in new learning space. In particular, the other university in Sheffield, Sheffield Hallam University, which is one of the former polytechnics in the UK. Many of you will know, I'm sure, that the university system in the UK was a binary system until the early 1990s. And one of the interesting things for us in a research-intensive university has been the way in which the former polytechnics have actually leapt ahead of the older universities in terms of their thinking about learning spaces. So we were very conscious that we were falling behind. The other things that were happening around this time, in the sort of early to mid-1990s, were a low level of student satisfaction and the creation of a new department of computing services, the director of which I'm pleased to say is in the audience today. And when that new department was set up under new and excellent leadership, it became apparent to us very quickly that the two services, the university library and the computing service, were in the same business. And the business was providing spaces for students to learn in. Also at about that time, in the mid-1990s, the English Higher Education Funding Council introduced its first capital funding for learning and teaching. And this seemed to us like too good an opportunity to miss in terms of developing new space. So all of these features really came together at the same time to enable us to start to conceive and visualize a new kind of library, a new kind of space. And it's about that space that we'll be talking. But first of all, I think we need to think about how do you convince senior university management to put its hand in its pocket to the extent of $50 million. At least it was $50 million last week. And to some extent, with libraries, you can see that the conventional kind of net present value analysis that you use for looking at the return on investment in capital projects doesn't really apply with library buildings. It's very difficult to demonstrate a bottom line for a new information commons or a new library. In purely financial terms. And it took us probably a couple of years to convince the accountants in the university that they were barking up the wrong tree if they were just looking at the bottom line in terms of cost and revenue. What you have to do really is to look at the impact that a future loss of student recruitment would have on the bottom line of the institution. If we continue to fall behind our competitors in terms of the quality of our study space. The other thing that I should just mention is that by 2000, plans were underway in the UK for the first national student survey. And this was a very important catalytic factor, really, in getting universities in the UK to think about the student experience, especially, I should say, universities like Sheffield, which is a very successful university. But like a lot of research-intensive universities, its three top priorities were research, research, and research. And actually getting the student experience on the agenda in the university was a significant challenge for us. The final factor in building the business case is something that was quite controversial, at least within the library, and that was our commitment to a policy that we call zero net collections growth. And, you know, put simply, this means that we're not going to grow our print collection anymore. And this was a way of enabling us to to go to the university and saying, in effect, that by building a $50 million information commons, we can save you at least another $50 million because we're not going to ask for a new research library. We're going to prioritize study space and we're going to manage within the capacity for print collections that we currently have. So our collection size is capped at about 1.5 million volumes, not very big by North American standards, but given the resources of the British Library and the network that exists in the UK for interlending and document supply, we feel that this is a good use of resources because our challenge is to make those 1.5 million volumes matter. So we want to make sure that the collection is managed actively and that those printed volumes really earn their keep. And the way that we're approaching this, you can see that the theoretical kind of smooth approach to the maximum capacity has actually not been anything like it. In practice, what we've had is a number of one-off disposal opportunities where typically we've been able to dispose of printed journals where we have secure electronic access. And gradually, over time, the gradient of the curve reduces as we move to more electronic-only subscriptions and we start to think about disposing of monographs. The bottom line here, I think, is that it's very hard in the modern environment to demonstrate an effective business case for building extra print capacity for storing low-use collections. And that was a very difficult nettle that we had to grasp in the late 1990s, but it did enable us to factor that into the planning for the information commons and to help to win support for the project. So moving on then to the design of the information commons, I want to start with this picture of a table, because the information commons, in a sense, was designed from the inside out. We started with the workplace, and this is an example here of a table. And in the spirit of Monty Python, we were thinking, how could we ruin this table? Well, one good way to ruin a table is to put a PC on the top of it. And this is, I apologize to those of you who are IT managers here and who may be offended by my characterization of a PC as being a negative instrument here. But what we're looking at is a relatively modest size workspace where you plonk down a PC in the middle of the desk and you immediately stop the possibility of using the rest of that desk for anything else. So there is nothing wrong with a PC, but there's a lot wrong with a smallish table with a large PC stuck on it with the intention of that being a student learning space. So a key thing for us really is the ergonomics of study space design. And in thinking about ergonomics, this is an example of poor ergonomics. One thinks about how automotive design has changed over the last 50 years. This is a 1958 Buick, and you can see that the emphasis is on style here rather than on functionality. And there are several very nice sharp edges, I think, designed to kneecap you in the event of an accident. But it does have a certain style. Fast forward 50 years, and we see that the design of the automotive interior has changed quite significantly. A number of improvements and advances have been made, notably moving the steering wheel to the correct side. And the use of LCD screen technology to convey a lot of information with not too many dials and knobs. And my thanks to Toyota for that image and the $10,000 I'm expecting off my next car. So thinking about study space design here, this is a picture of a study space in the IC. And one of the key things for us about this is the size of the desk. This is a typical individual study space. And we wanted to achieve a minimum width of 1.5 meters. On that space. And the unit allocation for a study space is 4.2 square meters. Now, we were kind of fishing in the dark a bit here because it's a long time since any agency in the UK set out any space norms for library-type study spaces. And in fact, the last ones that were published and adopted nationally specified an average space of 2.4 square meters. And it's very clear to us that if you want students to work effectively at a space like this, you have to give them a lot more than 2.4 square meters. And I have to say that, like all capital projects, this one came under huge financial pressure in the course of its evolution. And we had to fight very hard to resist the temptation to increase the density of study spaces. It's a false economy, because one of the things about the building that works very well is that you can actually achieve 100% occupancy and it doesn't feel full. Very often, if you cram spaces in, students start to overflow, bags start to be accumulated around desks, and actually the last sort of 25% of students have a job fighting their way into that environment. So the study space was designed to give students ample space to use printed collections and electronic materials in an integrated way. And we had some good evidence for this because the PCs that were most heavily used on the campus before the opening of this building were the ones in libraries. And there were a number of reasons for that, partly the proximity to the printed collections, partly the availability of help and support, and partly the quality of the environment. But I have to say that fighting for this space in a 1,300-seat building was quite a significant undertaking. So what we have here is the opportunity for the student to engage really in all parts of the independent learning process in the same space. And what it enabled us to do was to break down the spatial separation of different parts of the learning process that had existed previously. I'm sure it's the same in many of your institutions, but we had observed a lot of students working quietly in the library with papers and books spread out around them, doing their research, and then having to move physically to access word processing facilities or to look up electronic journal articles. I mean, this is clearly ludicrous. But nevertheless, in the course of working on this building, we actually visited a number of other new buildings where they said to us, well, these are the library spaces, and then here is the PC cluster. The PC cluster, in my view, is dead. I think that's an anachronistic concept now. So the idea is that we don't have separate PC areas in the information commons. The whole building becomes an integrated learning environment. So let's just have a look inside the building. This is the entrance level. We make extensive use of plasma screens for signage. Again, this is not rocket science. A lot of people are doing this. But what's interesting when you're planning a new capital spend is how the cost of this kind of solution has come down relative to the cost of high-quality static architectural signage, which actually costs a fortune and is out of date almost from the moment you install it. So we're very pleased with the impact that the plasma screens have had. And you can see that we use the plasma screens to convey calming images to students as well. It's obviously spring when this photograph was taken, I think. But we've got opportunities to pump all sorts of information through the screens, and they've worked very well for us. Group study rooms are a kind of space that we didn't have before. So we've introduced a number of group study spaces, and the objectives for these are to make them visually open, but with a very high level of acoustic separation from the rest of the space. Within the floor plan, we've tried to achieve more organic layouts, trying to get away from the rows and rows of desks and the regimented feel that you do get in a number of buildings. So these kind of monolinear spaces where the furniture looks rather randomly scattered is actually very effective in ensuring that students aren't kind of staring at each other, but you don't need extensive use of partitions to break up the space. So our experience, again, has been that this has worked quite well. This is a flexi space that we have on one of our levels where all the furniture is on wheels. Again, this is not a unique concept. We were heavily influenced by the University of Warwick, which had just introduced its learning grid before the Information Commons opened, and encouraged us to experiment with mobile furniture. This has been very successful. We find that the students negotiate between themselves how to lay the space out with very little staff intervention. We were a bit concerned about students having races with the furniture on wheels late in the evening. It's not been a huge problem for us. And all sorts of things happen in that space. And this is a picture of somebody actually doing some rapid prototyping in the flexi space. So this is the kind of thing that people get up to in the modern university library. And this is the same space being used on another occasion to actually host a seminar as part of a conference. So the flexi space concept has worked very well. We've tried to create internal views everywhere within the building so that people can lift their eyes up from their work and refocus on a distance. And the external views that we have in the building are also important. The architects paid a great deal of attention to allowing people to have snapshots of the view around the building. Having a lot of double and triple height spaces also helps to create a feeling of lightness and airiness within the building. And I think something that's particularly important for us in developing the brief of the building was this space within it, which is a kind of a two-story box, which is completely acoustically insulated, so that the option is available for people, and there they are inside it, to study in silence. Now, as a librarian, I never thought I would advocate using the word silence in a presentation, because it's redolent of all those outdated and anachronistic occupational stereotypes which are so stressful to us. Of course, most of the people in this room will realize that librarianship is right up there with neurosurgery and being a test pilot in terms of stress levels. But the point I wanted to make here is that silent study space is something there's huge demand for. And again, in the course of planning the building, we visited a lot of places where there was an intention to grade the space acoustically within the space, and they said, this is the quiet end, this is the noisy end, and we've got the book stacks, and they attenuate the noise and all the rest of it. In fact, in all of those spaces, without exception, we found that the so-called quiet end was still far too noisy. So right from the outset, we had a lot of demand, particularly from students in the arts and social sciences, for the ability to work in silence. So we've created this volume, this two-story volume with a gallery. It contains approximately 200 seats, so it's about 15% of the total study space. We have some classrooms in the building. There are two of them, using modern symposium technology so that we can work in groups, we can work in single classes, we can work as individuals, and those spaces are thrown open when they're not booked and are available for students to study in quietly. We have a 70-seat cafe. There it is. Business has picked up a bit, I'm glad to say. That was taken before the building opened. So what you've seen here is that a key objective for us throughout this building was to create a great deal of variety in the study environment. And although I didn't want to show too many tech slides, I thought it might be interesting for you to see the typology of spaces that emerged during the discussions that we had about the building. There were, broadly speaking, these nine types of space that we identified during the planning. But we rapidly discovered that there were some missing types of space. And I mentioned silent study. Interestingly, the original concept that we had for silent study was no IT. Although the building is capable of housing IT throughout and there's wireless throughout, the original idea was that we wouldn't allow IT in the silent study space. And it became clear to us that there was demand, first of all, for silent study space with laptop provision. So we opened up one of the two decks in the silent study space for laptops. And then, slightly more surprisingly, at least to me, there was significant demand from people for silent study space with desktop PC provision. So we were able to zone some of the existing areas as silent study space without difficulty, because we had some spaces that were relatively enclosed where we could do that. And I think what this demonstrates very clearly is that your new building has to have the flexibility to accommodate changes in use that you don't foresee at the time you did the planning. Another point which is perhaps worth emphasizing is that the requirement varies in time as well as space. So if you're thinking about the different acoustic regimes in a building, during the assessment period, for example, you find that the demand for silent study space shoots up very rapidly. Students want space to revise in and to work quietly. So we found ourselves zoning some of the additional spaces in the building to enable that to happen. So I think when you're thinking really about the building spaces that you have, there are a number of different dimensions to this, and it will vary from building to building, but you can look at the kind of working methods for the students. You can look at the acoustic regimes. You can look at the different IT environments that you want to develop. And then there are a number of other dimensions to take into account as well. For example, the openness of the building. A lot of people like working in large, airy, open spaces. Other people prefer to wedge themselves into kind of nooks and crannies. And so ideally, you want your building to be able to deliver as many of those spaces as possible. So acoustic management is very important, and we've kind of grouped our noisy stuff together in this way on every level in the building and surrounded it with high-performance acoustic enclosures. But key considerations for us were light, space, and colour. And you'll notice here that in Sheffield, the sky is always blue. It hardly ever rains, unlike in Florida. And we've tried to admit as much natural light into the building without solar glare as we can. So we have a lot of northern light in the building. And other features here are the mirror lights that we've used to light some of the double and triple height spaces. These are quite nifty because, of course, you only need a short stepladder to change the bulbs in these things if they go. And somewhat to people's surprise, when they first come in, they see that the background illumination is actually quite low. So it's only 150 lux, which is really quite subdued. But we supplement that with task lighting to the desktop and to the bookshelves to increase the level of illumination. And generally, that seems to work very well because at night time, it does give the building quite a cozy feel. You increase the level of background illumination if you want to, but what you then tend to get is a rather clinical and sterile feeling environment. So a low level of background illumination is actually very successful in creating that sort of warmer ambience. Now, I think partnership is crucial here. And here's a fine partnership. A couple of people about to go into bat. And we had a lot of fun working with the architects during the course of the building. And one of the techniques that we used was to give them a narrative of a student in the future. Now, this was written back in 2002, when we could only dream about what the future might be like in 2007. Who knew what kind of technological advances might happen in 2007? But we did our best, and it did help, I think, the architects to get a feel for what we were trying to achieve. And the brief for the building, I think, and this is a point we will tease out, I think, a little bit more, it would be nice to feel that you started off with a detailed and thorough analysis of your user needs. But actually, because of the lead time for developing a building on this scale, it's only partly evidence-based. We had to make some guesses about the future. We needed to work out the shortfall in study spaces, so we knew how many study spaces our competitors were providing, and we did the work on that. And the brief was actually agreed over 4 years before the building opened. And I think hearing from a number of other presentations at this conference about the pace of development in instructional technology and in learning styles, that's really quite a long lead time. The key phrase for us was the integrated learning environment, for the reasons I've explained, really, to do with bringing together the different parts of the learning function. We wanted the LRC, as it was originally called, to meet the study and learning needs of the students of today and, as far as possible, those of the future. And I think it is difficult to predict at this stage how learning styles will develop. We know that a lot of campus-based universities are making more use of blended learning, and Phil is going to talk a little bit more about how pedagogy has evolved in relation to spaces. A useful technique for trying to get the library and the computing services clients to think about the building was this technique of semantic differentials. And I'll just explain what this means. This is kind of based on personal construct theory, but the idea is you talk about the kind of things that matter to you in a building, and then you set up these ranked pairs of different features, different qualities, and then you try and put on a scale between those two extremes where you want your project to sit. And there are no defined lists of attributes. You actually come up with your own. And generally, a couple of glasses of wine helps this process enormously. And some of them are quite sensible, and some of them are quite silly. So, for example, we had Nordic and Mediterranean, and grey and colourful, and new university and old university. Now, we're an old university, by British standards, that is, and we wanted the building to reflect the gravitas that we felt it actually deserved. But in other respects, we wanted to have modern. So we were setting up some conflicts there for the architects, which I think they resolved very well. And then they showed us a load of pictures, and these are some of the images that inspired us. And this is an image of a design for a food hall in a department store. And what that was about was the kind of quality of spaces, the shapes, the lack of regimentation, the organic feel again. And that was quite important in our thinking about the sizes and shapes of spaces. This is a nice picture of the public library at Linköping in Sweden. And you can see these lovely rows of Arne Jacobsen-designed egg chairs in front of this double-height space. So if I show you these pictures of the information commons, you'll see that once we saw those egg chairs, we had to have them. Of course, we couldn't afford them. So this is where the university's development and alumni relations office came into play, because we were able to put back a little bit of surprise and delight in the building once the budget had been slashed, as of course these things always are, by going to them, and they funded these gorgeous chairs which sit in those four-storey north lights that I showed earlier. This is another iconic library building from the Netherlands, by Francine Huben of the Mekenu Architects. This is the Technical University at Delft, a beautiful library which I finally visited earlier this year in reality, but actually quite a traditional library in the sense that it has quiet spaces and separate PC clusters, so it wasn't what we were looking for in terms of the information commons, but nevertheless stunning architecture. Another very influential design has been this one, the Peckham Public Library in London, designed by the architect Will Allsop, who very much likes buildings on legs. And you can see a bigger version of this building at the Ontario College of Art and Design in Toronto, which is absolutely stunning. And then finally, it may seem strange to put this slide back up again, but this old girl here is a remarkable building, because that library is 50 years old, and at the time it was hailed as a major piece of modern design. It's a shame about the inside, but the outside is a very high quality architecturally, and it's already been listed by the British Heritage Authorities as a listed building. And this is what we ended up with. So here are some facts and figures, which I won't bore you with too much. And there is our building. And I'm now going to pass over to Phil, who's going to talk to us a little bit more about a crucial part of the Information Commons, which is the Centre for Inquiry-Based Learning in the Arts and Social Sciences.
Thanks, Martin. Yes, good morning, everybody. I'm going to talk about SILAS, as Martin has introduced it, which is a Centre for Excellence in Teaching and Learning, which is located within the Information Commons. This is our website, so please do visit the website and take a look at what we do if you're interested. I'll just say a little bit of background about where SILAS arose, and then talk about the design of the spaces that we host within the Information Commons in relation to the pedagogy of inquiry-based learning, which is our particular thematic focus as a centre for excellence in teaching and learning. So SILAS is one of 74 CETLs, Centres for Excellence in Teaching and Learning, that were set up by the Higher Education Funding Council for England in 2005, representing the very biggest investment in teaching enhancement in the UK ever. So we're talking about a £350 million investment in teaching enhancement to fund a number of CETLs, 74 CETLs, over a five-year programme each. This included for each CETL around about £4.5 million, divided between funds for capital investment and funds for developmental activity. And we were very fortunate in Sheffield to be awarded the full £4.5 million to focus our settle on inquiry-based learning specifically, and with about £2 million worth of funding to go into capital investment for the development and refurbishment of new teaching and learning spaces. Why were we interested in inquiry-based learning? Well, we have a very strong alignment as a settle with the university's strategic interests in teaching and learning generally. So the University of Sheffield is very committed to providing opportunities for students, for all students, to engage in inquiry-based learning through their degree. It's intended to be a key focus, a key experience for students at the university, all students, during their degree programme. So there is this very close alignment there. We as a settle have a particular focus on inquiry in the arts and social sciences, but also a remit to extend engagement across different subject areas. So what we were able to do, we were very fortunate, actually, that the funding from HEFCE, from the Higher Education Funding Council, for settles came through at just the right moment for us in terms of the planning that was already going on for the information commons. And we were able to say, ah, yes, if we get this funding, what we would like to do with it is actually accommodate a centre for excellence in teaching and learning, a developmental centre for teaching and learning, and inquiry-based learning specifically, in this very same building. And that's what we did, spending around about £1.8 million of our capital funding within the settle on creating a new space for ourselves in that building and bringing an educational development focus into the information commons and a teaching and learning activity focus, formal teaching and learning activity through classrooms. I'll say just a little bit about inquiry-based learning. Inquiry-based learning is a pedagogy that can be carried out right from primary school upwards. It's not just applicable to university-level students. It's essentially all about teaching and learning, which is directed by the student experience of self-directed inquiry or research at the heart of the learning experience, with all resources and activities designed to support that process. So very much a form of active learning. We might, for example, typically think of student research projects of different kinds and scales, and case-based learning, problem-based learning, experiential learning in applied professional contexts very often. That kind of learning activity. In terms of the inquiry-based learning process might look like, that's going to be different in different disciplines according to the nature of the scholarly and research process itself. But very typically, we might be thinking about the kind of activities and processes that students will engage with would start out with establishing a question. The core of inquiry-based learning is always really the question as a point of departure, whether that's established by students or tutors or by negotiation amongst them. And then students move on to pursuing lines of inquiry, very often collaboratively, very often in groups. So collaborative learning is a very, very important principle for inquiry-based learning, as is student autonomy and independence. Students would be encouraged typically to reflect on and draw on their existing knowledge, identify their new learning and information needs, and then spend time interacting with information resources, digital archives, information resources of all kinds, to gather information, analyse it, examine it, synthesise it, communicate their ideas and results, and very much a pedagogy that's interested in new partnership models of working between students and staff. So the idea that staff are scholars, staff are researchers, but also students are novice researchers and scholars in their own right. And this kind of pedagogy gives us an opportunity for students and staff to work in partnership. So these photos that I've shown you show, well, this one in particular, shows the end result of one process of inquiry that level one students in my own department went through, where they're presenting, in fact, the results of their research project at the end of the project. I wanted to put this slide in because I think it's quite interesting and important that there's quite a good affinity, I think, between the ethos and philosophy of Web 2 and inquiry-based learning, with that kind of emphasis on autonomy, collaboration, social learning, students as producers and creators of learning and content, rather than simply as consumers. And I also wanted to flag up that SciLess itself has a virtual space as well as a real physical space in the Information Commons, and this is part of that virtual space there. Inquiry-based learning goes on in all sorts of strange places. This is a picture taken from one of our Level 2 modules in archaeology, which was a module that was completely redesigned from a rather traditional lecture plus seminar-based module to a module where students were taken out at the very beginning of the semester into the field, in this case into a historic cemetery in Sheffield, and essentially invited to look around and think about what interested them, what kind of questions came into their minds, what did they want to pursue, what lines of inquiry did they want to pursue. And I think you can see here from this student quote, reflecting back to the purposes and aims of inquiry-based learning, what this student says about what she gained from that process. Okay, so this slide really just to say, to keep the emphasis on this, in terms of designing and facilitating IBL, what instructors are thinking about is centrally the inquiry task, and then a number of different factors that need to be taken into account in designing or redesigning a module, learning spaces being a really critical aspect of that. And we know, of course, that inquiry-based learning, it's not easy to carry out inquiry-based learning in traditional spaces which have been designed for a completely different kind of pedagogic interaction and relationship. So in SciLess, we encourage our colleagues to think in terms of how they're going to use space and to design in, as it were, their use of spaces and technologies right from the start. We have a particular interest in SciLess then on the idea of classrooms as research environments in and of themselves, as well as our other themes, which I've just highlighted here on this slide. And we were really very fortunate in having this opportunity with the SETL funding to really ask ourselves, well, what kind of spaces are appropriate and relevant for supporting the kinds of inquiry process in the classroom that I've just outlined? We kind of know what a research laboratory looks like in the sciences. You know, it's full of equipment, lots of benches with people wandering around in white coats. We know what a laboratory is like in the sciences, what a research location is. What is it in the arts and social sciences? Well, perhaps it has the features of a traditional library, for one thing, access to information resources of different kinds. But also, colleagues and students were telling us they wanted other features. They wanted features which would enable and encourage collaborative inquiry, movement around the spaces, good flow from one activity to another, groups interacting with each other, presentations being able to be given, students being able to work individually on different projects at the same time. This kind of interaction. This is a picture of one of the spaces that we then designed within the Information Commons. I won't read out all the facilities that there are there. You can look it up on the web. But I will just point out one of the features of this particular space, which is that the desks were very much designed to encourage staff, academic staff, to think in terms of designing activities that would enable students to work together collaboratively using information technology to access information resources. There's another picture of that space from another angle, which shows the seamless interface of the space with the wider resources of the Information Commons. And that's the same space, full, very full, of law students, actually, in this case, busy working on group projects in an inquiry-based learning module. We have another space within the Information Commons as well. We call it Collaboratory 2. rather a dull picture in a way, but what that simply shows is it's a more flexible space, wheels on the tables, easy to move back. We've got video conferencing there. We've got write on wallpaper. People love to stand up and move around these spaces, write on the walls. They can capture what they're writing by using our huddle board and copy cam facilities, which are essentially digital cameras that sort of stick on an arm off the wall and enable you to capture what you've written and then upload it to a web server for reuse later on. So this space, very popular space, there it is in use. We have further facilities. We have breakout rooms, group rooms. We also have another space in a different part of the university. This was a very useful thing for us because we actually were able to develop this space. It's a refurbished space. Before we created the spaces within the Information Commons. And that was a very, very useful small-scale design testbed for us. So in this space, as you can see, we've got, again, the flexible tables, laptop provision. There is cluster connectivity between the laptops and the plasma screens. So students can work in small groups and display what they do from the laptops to the screens which are around the room and, you know, move around the room looking at each other's work, push the tables away, use the space in very, very flexible ways. And that was a very useful way of helping us to think about how we wanted to design the spaces in the Information Commons. What about the impact of these spaces? I won't say very much about this. This slide really just flags up that we're using a particular evaluation framework, both within SILAS and within the library, called the Theory of Change Evaluation Framework, to look at the impact of what we've done on the student learning experience and on the development of pedagogy. So you can see on the right-hand side of that table our desired outcomes. We have impact outcomes that we're looking for, indicators there. We're looking for learning and teaching at the university to be enhanced. But we also identify activities and processes and resources and enablers, that things that, you know, the processes that we hope will lead to that particular outcome. And here I've just flagged up, really, that the design and use of new spaces was seen right from the very start as a really critical enabling factor for us in enhancing the learning experience and in developing pedagogy. So evaluation questions that we have now at this stage are things like, you know, are teaching and learning being enhanced through the new learning spaces that we have? How are staff and students using these spaces? What is it in the ways that they're using these spaces that is having the impact, the desired impacts? Or are there any unanticipated impacts that we hadn't seen? So lots of questions we're pursuing at the moment. We know from our evaluation, which I'll just say a little bit about now, that really what lecturers were most looking to do was to embed inquiry activity in real time in the classrooms. You could see this kind of as an inverted classroom, if you like, where they usually you might say you might see information being transmitted in the classroom and research activity going on outside. Actually, with us, it's the other way around. So lecturers were looking for spaces which would enable them to do that, get students working together. The kind of things that they're going on in SILAS spaces, this was two colleagues running a module in English language and literature on Alex Haley's book Roots, and they identified these things that students were doing in their class, in the SILAS class, across this module. Students were getting organised with their research, they were able to talk tête-à-tête, they were using the very big floor actually to do some quite creative exercises, thinking exercises, but using movement as well. They were logging on, they were looking at resources, they were having a multimedia experience, they were using music as well as voice archives. They were watching movie clips. They were able to go off to the IC and get, you know, check out resources in the wider IC. They were able to get into huddles on the huddle boards. And they were holding what they call the main event, the sort of mini conference at the end of the module to present students' work. So those were the kinds of things that they were doing. What do students and staff value in our spaces? These kinds of things I'll pick out. You can read the quotes, but I'll pick out informality, very, very important, a different kind of relationship between peer-to-peer relations and also between students and staff, intensity of relations, freedom, movement, all these things, very, very important. Changing the emotional climate of the classroom and freeing up thinking. So lecturers are observing that students have changed in their behaviours, more participative, more confident, more relaxed, more independent, and so on, more engaged. Just a few quotes here to conclude with around what staff felt that the impact of the spaces was on their own pedagogical thinking and development. So the flexibility of the spaces, the new features of the spaces, were getting them to think in fresh ways about pedagogy, taking their own thinking further in terms of what inquiry-based learning might mean in their own discipline areas. So an interesting cause and effect relationship there. Changed learning and teaching relationships, I've already mentioned. And this lecturer in this quote says, in these new spaces, we're all researchers together. And that's a very different kind of relationship. Also very interesting, I think, these spaces, because tutors and lecturers are actually witnessing students using information resources in classroom, they're becoming more aware of information literacy development issues and problems and challenges and ways in which they, as faculty, can actually help students and support them. So it seems to bring information literacy to the fore within the classroom much more. Okay, that's me. I've finished what I wanted to say. Back to Martin for a very quick roundup.
Yeah, thanks very much, Phil. I'm conscious of time. The Information Commons, needless to say, has been very heavily used since it was opened, and you can see some of the data here. But what has been interesting for us to see is that overall usage of our system has gone up. The traditional library has seen a reduction in footfall, but not in occupancy. And one of the objectives for us with the Information Commons is to take the opportunity of that reduction in footfall to repurpose the old library as a new research space. And there's been a lot of interesting discussion at the conference this year about the Research Commons as an equivalent learning space or research space for our researchers. These are some quotations from students that we've picked up since the IC opened. And that's my favourite one, I think, there at the bottom. I think that has something to do with the fact that Zed in Men in Black actually sits in an Arne Jacobsen-designed egg chair in his office. So I think the student reaction has generally been pretty good. Finally, some learning points for us. The IC and similar buildings, really, not about technology. And we had a lot of questions from senior officers in the university trying to get us to justify the investment, saying, aren't buildings now anachronistic? Aren't students doing everything, you know, portable devices, everything all the time? And the answer is no. They have to sit down somewhere if they're going to use those things. And really, as contact time reduces in a lot of universities, the independent learning time becomes even more important. Students spend more time in libraries, in computer laboratories, and in other independent learning spaces than they do in classrooms and laboratories. And this is just a slide which demonstrates the timeline that I was talking about earlier in terms of the guesswork that we had to do early on. And I think the lesson here is that although we can be sensitive to changes in pedagogy, we actually, if we're talking about major new builds, have to be prepared to take some risks. We ask the customers what they want, but we have to recognize the customers don't always know what they want a long way ahead of time. With smaller scale projects, perhaps, you have more of an opportunity to put into practice the stuff that you've learned about pedagogy. And finally, just to say that it's all about the student experience. And some very apposite quotations here that make the point that we're creating opportunities for students. How the students use those spaces, I think, is very much up to them. And we're still learning, in the case of this building, how the students are going to make that work. Just very quickly, what about this name, the Information Commons? We said that this was the first one in the UK. Well, it's not the first advanced learning space in the UK, but it's the first time that we've used this name, Information Commons. And the word commons has some interesting connotations in the UK. People tend not to associate it with a shared space, not until now. And what we're finding is that we have an opportunity to bring that usage of the word commons back home to the UK, where it started. The commons was always the original enclosure. For all the lack of enclosure of space, the enclosures happened then and took the commons away, of course. We want to bring that concept of the shared space back to the UK. And we wanted to reflect the degree of innovation that had gone into thinking about the space. So there we are. That's the University of Sheffield. A quick plug. There is the Information Commons in the cityscape. Sheffield has a tradition of architectural innovation and risk-taking. This is a massive housing development called the Park Hill Estate in Sheffield, based on some of the principles of Le Corbusier, generally hated by the people who live there, but nevertheless a stunning building. This is the Arts Tower, which is a one-half scale model of the Seagram building in New York, which graces the university campus at the moment in Sheffield. And finally, this is a car park in the city. So there we are. This is a goodbye from us. We hope if you're on our side of the pond and you have the opportunity to visit, you'll take that opportunity to do so. I think, Andrew, we've got 1 or 2 minutes for questions.
If we hurry.
We will indeed. Thank you very much. Yes.
We're beginning to explore learning spaces
in our
institution.
Yeah, I should just say that because they're recording the session, the organizers have asked that you come to the microphone. Alternatively, we will be happy to repeat the questions for you.
We're beginning to explore learning spaces at our institution, but the conversation's been focused around bringing together student affairs staff and students, and it seems like your focus was more on teaching and faculty and students. Did you consciously exclude like academic advisors, career counselors, registrar staff, offices that students don't usually have a lot of traffic to,
Sure. Bringing
them together?
Yeah. I hope everybody heard that. The question was about other functions coming into this kind of space. We did give it quite a bit of thought, but I think in the end, because of the pressures that we had on budget and space, we needed to prioritize those functions that we brought into this particular space. The building does have the scope to be extended, and an option for us in the future is to look at bringing those student-facing services into the building. And there are a number of institutions which have achieved that very successfully. The new learning centre at Glasgow Caledonian University does exactly that by bringing student services staff, careers counsellors into the same building, and I think that works very successfully. So I think it's an important point. If you have the opportunity to build those in from the outset, I would say go with it.
Thanks very much, Andrew.
This EDUCAUSE 2008 Annual Conference podcast is sponsored by Real Networks. Outsourced hosting of multi-format digital media content is available from Real's own CDN, the Real Broadcast Network. Information at rbn.com.